to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, January 26, 2015, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, we'll be discussing the very recent cert grant by the U.S. Supreme Court in four gay marriage cases. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording this call for use as a podcast in the future. Our experts for today are Ilya Shapiro. He's a senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Cato Institute here in Washington, D.C., and he's joined by Professor Jared V. Bradley from the University of Notre Dame Law School. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of about 6 to 8 minutes or so, maybe a little bit of back and forth, but then, as always, questions from the audience. So please do be ready with your questions when we get to that portion of the program. Now, for the opening remarks, we're going to get some background first from Ilya Shapiro and his opening statement. Let us know how these cases made their way to the Supreme Court and why they were granted and maybe some of the previous cases weren't. But with that, Mr. Shapiro, the floor is yours.
Thanks very much, Dean. It's a pleasure to be on this program opposite such a distinguished scholar like Professor Bradley. I don't know where to start with this history of same-sex marriage. I guess with the last time this issue was before the Supreme Court 2 years ago, famously in June 2013, the Supreme Court punted on the issue of gay marriage itself, dismissing the Prop 8 challenge, Perry versus Hollingsworth, on standing grounds in a heterodox alignment of justices, and at the same time striking down Section 3 of the Defense of Marriage Act in the case of United States versus Windsor. Since that time, district courts in what Wikipedia tells me is 27 states and state courts in 6 states have found that same-sex marriage bans violate the U.S. Constitution. So I'm sure that's about accurate, plus or minus. And also in the courts of appeals, the 4th, 7th, 9th, and 10th circuits have affirmed the unconstitutionality of such laws, while the Sixth Circuit, which is a group of cases that the Supreme Court will now be hearing, did not. That's what set up the circuit split. More recently, in October of this past year, the Supreme Court declined to grant cert, denied the petitions of cases from a number of states out of the 7th and 10th and 4th circuits. At that time, there was no circuit split, and declined to issue stays either. So at this point, I believe there's same-sex marriage licenses available in 36 states. The Ninth Circuit soon joined those circuits as well. But a month later, in November, as I said, the Sixth Circuit, in a 2-1 opinion by Judge Jeffrey Sutton, upheld the respective marriage laws of Ohio, Tennessee, Michigan, and Kentucky. And so we have this case, which, unless the parties' names change, will be known as Obergefell versus Hodges. That's the Ohio case, and that's the one that's the lead case, simply because it was the lowest docket number. I don't know if it won the race to the courthouse, but or some lottery at the Supreme Court clerk's office. But that is the name of the case, Obergefell versus Hodges, because that's kind of hard to say. I'm sure we'll keep talking about these as the gay marriage cases. Curiously, the Supreme Court didn't simply grant this or other petitions and thereby accept the questions presented as the parties framed them. Instead, it wrote its own question, and this may or may not indicate something substantive, but here are the two precise questions that the Supreme Court will be looking at, presumably with argument in April, based on the way that the a brief schedule order came down. First, does the 14th Amendment require a state to license a marriage between two people of the same sex? And secondly, does the 14th Amendment require a state to recognize a marriage between two people of the same sex when their marriage was lawfully licensed and performed out of state? So there's a lot of tea leaf reading about why it rephrased these questions, why did it pick these two, with the court setting up the issue as a split-the-baby sort of situation where it would require states to recognize out-of-state marriages that are same-sex, that are lawfully licensed under those state laws, but not issue marriage licenses themselves. Perhaps this is a compromise that Roberts is trying to engineer with him and Kennedy as a controlling opinion. Unclear. But in any event, I'll shift now from talking about the background to giving a little bit of my views, and this isn't any secret or anything. Cato and I have been filing briefs going back to the Perry and Windsor cases, and since then in the lower courts, supporting the challenges to the state of marriage laws. Our briefs have specifically been on the equal protection issue, that is, if states set up this law, this institution called marriage, they have to make that available equally without getting into concerns about what is the right to marry, is it fundamental, is it recognized under substantive due process, these sort of carrier issues, or what some would consider to be carrier issues. Therefore, I was heartened by the Supreme Court's reframing or rephrasing of the issues, because it seems to play into more of an equal protection analysis rather than, you know, asking a question about does the fundamental right to marriage inure to same-sex couples or something like that. It might be six of one, half dozen of the other, and I'm sure we will get briefs that touch on substantive due process and the right of marriage and these sorts of things. But in any event, I think an equal protection ruling would be narrower and therefore is more likely, although if, as the conventional wisdom holds, Justice Kennedy ends up writing the majority or controlling opinion as he has in the last gay rights cases, not just Windsor, but also Romer versus Evans and Lawrence versus Texas, then it's likely to be kind of a combination of equality under the law and kind of Kennedy-esque vision of dignity of the individual and who knows what else. Throw in some sort of explanation of how federalism works and we'll just see what exactly comes out of it. But I do predict that that is what will happen. I think it'll be at least 5-4. Maybe Roberts joining in if there can be some sort of a narrower way, I don't know, or maybe Roberts joining in just on the second question about out-of-state recognition. But I think I have, my prediction is worth what you're paying for it, but I have more confidence in this one than I do in most times when I'm trying to forecast what the Supreme Court will do. And I think with that, I'll turn it over to Professor Bradley, and I look forward to everyone's questions.
Well, thank you, Ilya Shapiro. It's very much a pleasure to work with you on this teleforum. And thanks for the very able and I think accurate setup of the question. And thanks to the FedSoc for organizing this event. As Ilya Shapiro mentioned, there's some curiosity about the way the court went about reviewing these cases or setting up the review of these cases. They've consolidated four cases, which cases present a mix the straight-on question, you might say, of whether a state is required by the Constitution to have same-sex marriage. And the cases present also the question of recognition of out-of-state same-sex marriages. I think it's quite right, as Ilya Shapiro says, to stop and consider whether there is a story here, whether this combination of cases and the precise way in which the court has set up these two questions is a set of tea leaves staring at us from the bottom of the cup. I suspect there is a story there, although I don't myself think I can read with any reliability or clarity what the message is. I would say that, as Ilya suggests, there may be some inclination on the part of at least one member of the court, perhaps more than one member, to reach a compromise of sorts on the marriage issue, perhaps by just deciding that the Constitution requires states to recognize out-of-state same-sex marriages that is lawfully celebrated someplace else. I would say this is a possibility. It might well attract Justice Kennedy, conceivably John Roberts, although I suspect not. But Justice Kennedy is, I think, as most people do, the key vote. About him, I would say, based upon his track record in cases about same-sex attraction and gay rights, that It is very difficult to imagine Justice Kennedy voting against same-sex marriage, very difficult. On the other hand, it's not difficult to imagine him trying not to have to vote on the question. That is to say, looking at Lawrence and even the Windsor case, one way to read the shape of the opinions in those cases is to judge that Justice Kennedy is trying not to bring on, by virtue of judicial decree, judicial opinion, same-sex marriage across the country. Nonetheless, those opinions provide enough confidence, at least for me, to opine that if forced to choose between, in a straight-up vote, between pro or in favor of same-sex marriage or against, it is hard to see Justice Kennedy voting against same-sex marriage, but he may be looking for a way not to have to do that. So perhaps there is really some meaning in the way the tea leaves are arranged. I think myself that if a compromise of that sort is the rule of decision, that it would be an unwise move in the sense that it's not a stable compromise. I don't myself see how, based upon Windsor, Lawrence, and whatever else is said in these upcoming cases when they're decided, it's very hard to see how courts the day after this case, these cases are decided, if they're decided on compromise grounds, could uphold a distinction within a given state where states, that state is required to treat as married same-sex couples who happen to have been married elsewhere, but couples who have been living all their lives within that state and same-sex couples who would like to marry are denied the opportunity to marry legally. It's hard to see how that distinction would survive equal protection challenge. So I think it's an unstable compromise if a compromise is indeed in the offing. And perhaps it's intended by one or more of the justices party to it to be an unstable compromise, that it's meant to be the next push of the ball down the field where the final innings of the same-sex marriage argument are carried out in lower courts or perhaps in legislatures. Now, my own judgment about what the court ought to do with that prediction in hand is that the court ought to sustain states' authorities to decide what marriage will be and how the law will treat, that is, what kinds of relationships are treated as marriage within the states. So I would encourage the court to follow, in general outline, the opinion of Judge Sutton in the Sixth Circuit. I think that the basis for a contrary decision, that is to say, a decision in favor of same-sex marriage, is very likely to take off from the template of analysis that we see in Windsor. And by that I mean, and I think Ilya Shapiro referred to this template, where the key evaluative terms in Windsor are about dignitarian harms, about the indignity that same-sex couples suffer when they're not able to legally marry. And in Windsor, Justice Kennedy does use the term humiliation and the term demean, both with regard to the couple and children of any same-sex household. Now, I think that there's something to be said there, but I think that those terms have weaknesses, and I think fatal weaknesses, in two different ways when applied to this particular problem. One is that I think that although some states may choose to treat their marriage regime as vehicles for affirming the dignity of certain commitments or as ways in which the law and the communities whose law it is endorse or affirm particular relationships. That's one way to view marriage and law, I suppose, but I don't think it's the only way to view marriage and law. And I think that the Windsor case is guilty of a kind of gratuitous redefinition of what marriage law in that case in New York was for. I mean, in other words, Justice Kennedy in Windsor talks at great length about how what's at issue in the marriage regime in New York is this dignitarian harm and how the DOMER, the Defense of Marriage Act, would take away a dignity which New York has conferred on couples by and through the marriage laws. Now, this whole way of looking at marriage and law is one possible way to look at it. But the question really is whether the Constitution requires every state to treat its marriage law regime as I say, a vehicle for affirming dignity and avoiding humiliation and demeaning. The second problem, I think, with thinking this way is that it's a bit too late in the game. That is to say, we live in a society in which perhaps a bare majority of children live in households where they're not living with their mother and their father, which is to say simply that we live in a country where the non-marital household, as often as not perhaps populated by children, is common. Statistically, it's common. What I mean to say evaluatively is that I think in our society, the urgency that we see in Windsor for the community through its laws to affirm the relationships in non-marital households, that urgency, I think, has been diminished greatly by the cultural acceptance, normalization, and common fact that most households, it seems, are not marital. So to put it differently, I think our culture has adjusted to the presence of non-marital households with children, and I don't think in our culture there is such a premium as the Windsor Court suggests upon the law conferring dignity or stifling any humiliation or demeaning of these households. The last thing I'll say about the shape of an opinion in these cases is that whatever the result, or no matter what the result is, I think that the shape and rhetoric of the opinion, whatever exactly it holds, is both important. And the reason for that is that there will be lots of decisions, both in legislatures and in courts, downstream of these opinions, or the opinions in these cases, probably most notably on religious liberty questions, and secondarily about the secondary questions about the shape of the marital regime in the various states. So to put all of that a bit differently, I think it's very, very important to these downstream questions and how they're handled in both legislatures and in courts, that the Supreme Court refrain from the kind of rhetoric about those, or concerning those who oppose same-sex marriage. More specifically, I think it's vital that the Supreme Court, no matter what the outcome of the case is, happens to be, refrains from what appears to be their tendency or temptation, at least, to frankly demonize opponents of same-sex marriage as haters or bigots or people who are suffering from a sort of glut of prejudice, and denying in the process the reasonableness of the view which I hold about marriage and law and the meaning of the Constitution, but which was the view of the vast majority of American political leaders until 10 years ago, and was the view even of the President of the United States going back 6 or 7 years to the beginning of President Obama's term. So this rhetorical nuclear option that courts, including the Windsor Court, but especially the Circuit Courts of Appeals coming after Windsor, that they've deployed to demonize opponents of same-sex marriage, I think is unfortunate and false. But it's especially important that it be given up in these cases because of the effect of that rhetoric upon subsequent political and legal decisions concerning religious liberty and secondary questions about marriage. And with that, I'll turn it back to you, Dean, and to our callers.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Bradley, and thank you, Ilya Shapiro. I do want to get to the caller's questions. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we're all going to hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either or even both of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Looks like we've got a couple hundred people on the line with us today, and we've got 5 questions to start with. Before we turn to them, let me make a very brief announcement about upcoming Teleforum conference calls. First and foremost, we do have a web page where all the future scheduled calls appear. That's on the Federal Society's web page, and you can find that easily. But for tomorrow at 4 p.m., we have a Teleforum entitled Government Rights and Victims Wrongs, featuring victims advocate Paul G. Cassell, University of Utah Law School professor and a former federal judge. That's tomorrow at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Wednesday at 1 p.m., we'll be talking about the Keystone Pipeline and the recent Nebraska Supreme Court case with the litigator in that case. Thursday at noon, we'll be speaking with Ed Meese, who will be talking about voter ID and voter fraud. And then Friday at 1 p.m.,
We'll be talking about the Supreme Court's recent decision in the important Teva Pharmaceuticals case. Today, of course, Professor Jerry Bradley and Ilya Shapiro of Cato. With that, let's go to our first audience question.
Hi, this is Darren Bartram calling from D.C. I just wanted to put my interpretation of the questions presented out there for your reaction. When I look at the questions presented, I only come up with a yes to both questions. And I look at the second question. If that weren't a predetermined yes, the court would have considered whether, even if the 14th Amendment doesn't require recognition of out-of-state marriages, is recognition required by full faith and credit? And once you decide that states have to recognize out-of-state marriages, you then have to go back to the first question and ask if there's any basis for a state to distinguish between out-of-state gay marriages and in-state gay marriages. And based on Windsor, I think that takes you to a yes question for the first question, which in some ways obviates the need to get to the second one. But so I guess I look at the way the court framed those questions, and I see only a yes, not a compromise decision. And I'm wondering if you've thought about that as far as excluding the question of full faith and credit.
This is Ilya Shapiro. Yeah, I did find it curious that it was framed specifically with the 14th Amendment and not full faith and credit. I mean, I suppose you could go the other way and say, the 14th Amendment doesn't require that, and we'll leave the question of full faith and credit to another day. I suppose if you wanted to get to know on both questions, that's how you do it, and that could perhaps be the nature of the dissent. Maybe it was framed in that way particularly because the dissenters wanted not to have, other than Scalia perhaps, to have such a kind of a ringing dissent on the full square merits. I don't know, but it is a curiosity that full faith and credit did not come up in a rewrite of the questions.
Professor Bradley, you want to respond to this question?
Well, I agree it's a bit of a puzzle, and I don't myself attribute a knowing or a completely worked out answer to the court. It may be that the questions represent a kind of compromise or a political log rolling, but the best sense I can make of the questions is to think, and I think the caller may be saying this, and perhaps Ilya Shapiro saying this as well. I don't think that the compromise, if that's what it is, or this perhaps over clever way of putting the two questions, really hangs together. It seems to me that whether one asks the question about out-of-state marriages on the basis of full faith and credit, or asks that as a full faith and credit question, or asks it straight up about whether equal protection, or the 14th Amendment more generally, permits a state to decline to recognize out-of-state same-sex marriages, I think the answer comes down to the same thing, and it comes down to the same thing that'll determine the answer to the first question, which has to do with the rationality, the reasonableness, the cogency of any state's choice to treat opposite-sex couples interested in marriage as able to marry legally, but not to treat same-sex couples interested in marriage the same way. Now, if there is a rational and much more, if there's a cogent basis for distinguishing those couples, I think that would supply for the domicile state, if you will, a sufficient reason to rebut the presumption of recognition of same-sex marriage really required by full faith and credit. And it would supply the distinction that would rebut any claim that equal protection requires equal recognition of out-of-state marriages, and the same basis would rebut the argument that the Constitution requires a state to issue same-sex marriage licenses.
Let's go to another caller. Good
morning, at least this morning where I am in California. My name is Benjamin Pugh, one of Professor Bradley's former students, so hi, Professor.
Good morning, where you are.
I've got a question about possible compromise. In my mind, the question of gay marriage has always been whether a state must regulate same-sex couples and opposite-sex couples in exactly the same way. And that just doesn't make sense for a lot of practical reasons, like presumptions of paternity, for example, are ludicrous with same-sex couples. But on the other hand, there are lots of things in marriage laws that are not available to same-sex couples that that you can't even get via contract. And the one that I'm thinking most of is the marital privilege. Might there be, or has there ever been, I haven't really seen discussion to this, some sort of compromise where the court might say, look, these incidents to marriage are, depend on raising kids or anything to do with either same-sex or opposite-sex. Therefore, it's denial of equal protection to deny them to same-sex couples. But we're not going to force states to call them, use the same box, the same entire statutory and whatever legal scheme they've come up with for marriage for opposite-sex couples.
That's interesting, Ms. Delia Shapiro. I mean, that could be, I think it's a little, I think it might be overly legalistic in the sense that when we, last week was the Citizens United 5-year anniversary, so I've been doing some media on that subject, and it seems like when we're talking about corporate rights, you'll see where I'm headed here in a second, when we're talking about corporate rights, just because corporations can't have abortions or have the capital punishment applied to them, don't have personal privacy, these sorts of very tied to human beings sort of rights, doesn't mean we can't speak of corporate rights more broadly to the extent that they have rights. So similarly, I don't think the fact that not all incidents of marriage necessarily are relevant to every single marriage or every single type of marriage means that you need to treat them differently, or that you're authorized to treat them differently. And I hope that's sort of answering the question. At least those are the thoughts that were provoked as you were presenting your thoughtful take.
Mm-hmm. Well, Benjamin, I think you're onto something, but I think it's something that, at least in some intuitive way, has been on the minds of people party to this debate, and really in a certain fashion, in one way, shape, or another, part of the debate for some time. Because the way I think you put the question is quite nice. There are obvious shared characteristics between a committed same-sex couple and a married couple, a man and woman. And surely these shared characteristics can, maybe with minor qualifications I'll put aside for now, call for similar, if not identical, legal treatment. So if you have a same-sex couple, let's say unmarried in the state of Tennessee, but sharing a household, sharing an emotional life, and even in somehow raising a child together, then that similarity or those similarities to a married couple call, again, perhaps some qualifications, for similar or identical treatment to that received or enjoyed by the married couple. But I would call this the retail approach to marital equality, meaning to take up the similarities of de facto households or even de facto couples one by one or maybe in small clumps of issues and work towards a kind of practical, not equality with marriage, but a practical accommodation of the genuine needs and requirements of same-sex households, albeit unmarried, at least in our hypothesis. Now, I think that was the way a lot of people were thinking when they were talking about civil unions and domestic partnerships, and the way a lot of people were thinking about this issue, perhaps up until a few years ago, 5 years ago. But it seems to me at some point, and without any kind of conspiracy or joint conference call decision to do so, somehow the opinion or position congealed. I think this is largely on the other side of this argument, meaning the folks in favor of same-sex marriage, that the way to get equality was the goal, and it was an equality of dignity and acceptance, and that couldn't be had piecemeal, where the end result of the piecemeal approach would be something not quite like marriage-light or domestic partnership. So I think that the political, philosophical goals, if you will, of the same-sex marriage movement changed somewhere not too long ago to make the proposal that you are airing out obsolete.
Note to our callers, we've got about half dozen or so questions pending. We're going to try to get to all of them, so let's go to our next caller.
This is John Vecchione in Fairfax, Virginia. I think that the what the law says is sort of thrown out in this particular area of the law, and it's just a matter of what does Kennedy feel we can make up now on this subject. And in that vein, I'd like to ask both of our speakers the following, because Kennedy does have some views that the state should have free action, and of course he's been the main mover on gay rights on the court. So given that premise, and if I'm right about it, you can comment on that too, could he believe that since there are so many states' laws have been struck down already, they'd have to pass new laws in order to have new traditional marriage laws. He might think that the horse is out of the barn and he doesn't have to so alter state power, the state's powers in this area. So maybe he would go with, oh, the states can do what they want, but they have to recognize the other states' marriage laws as well. So since I do believe this is all made up non-constitutional law, it's just a matter of what's in Kennedy's head, what are your views on that?
Well, I have to say that your way of putting it, that it's all being made up by Justice Kennedy, is a view that infects my students in con law. And when it comes to the Windsor case, more than one student will raise his or her hand and say that isn't, you know, the professor's trying to teach law, and they say, isn't this just a matter of Kennedy's personal vision? Now, I think you've scoped it out just about right, that Justice Kennedy has somewhat conflicting loyalties. One is to federalism, or let's call it state sovereignty or state autonomy on the marriage issue, among other issues, and an obvious commitment to, and this is just one phrase, and there could be better phrases used, but a commitment to, let's call it gay equality, which goes back all the way to Roe versus Evans. And maybe, I think you're probably right that at some level of consciousness, Justice Kennedy is perhaps hoping that this works itself out without him applying a kind of heavy thumb to the scales of judgment. I think I mentioned earlier, he'd rather not have to do that. That's my own perception, not based on any insider access. And maybe he'll think that he can ride that out a bit longer, and that if the court nudges the ball forward in these cases, that the issue will sort of resolve itself down the road. It may well be what he was thinking in Windsor. And it may be what he thinks this June, when he writes an opinion, or joins an opinion at least, in these cases. But as to whether he'll do that or not, I wouldn't venture a guess. My recommendation would be for him to affirm the sort of federalism loyalties that he has, but I don't predict he'll do that.
This is Ilya Shapiro. I think I agree with the conclusion. Kennedy is not a complete cipher, like a black box that just, you know, depends on what he has for breakfast. I wrote a law review article, it must be 5 years ago now, I should probably update it, called The Sweet Mystery of Anthony Kennedy in the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy. It was actually a book review of a book that talked about how Kennedy was really a libertarian or a modest libertarian. The Tie Goes to Liberty, it's called, by Helen Knowles. What's so puzzling about Kennedy is that he doesn't think in kind of conventional areas of law or areas of doctrine. He is fairly predictable or consistent within his own framed or reframed areas. And so the advocate's goal is always challenge, is to frame the case in a way that makes Kennedy go to one side rather than the other. And for example, one of his issues is dignity. And so, for example, his opinions about gay rights aren't based in kind of a libertarian individual rights sort of ethos, but rather that a genteel society, a civilized society, treats people in a certain manner, and it's beneath our society to make these sorts of distinctions, qua Romer and Lawrence and Windsor sort of thing. It's kind of a noblesse oblige sort of dignitarianism rather than a libertarianism. Similarly, he believed strongly in federalism, not for its own sake or because that's the originalistic way of constitutional construction, but because federalism and constitutional structure is there to protect individual liberty and dignity. And so I think here you could very well see him say, states get to do lots of things, structures are very important, but that is up to a point, and just like states can't engage in certain kinds of oppressions or things that are uncivilized or however he wants to phrase it, they can't do it in that way here. But I think there are going to be, if he writes the opinion, some peons to the role, the kind of like in Windsor, mixing in the equality or equal liberty kind of themes with how our structure guarantees those protections, and in this case, how the judicial structure protects it against the state legislation or something like that.
Gentlemen, we still have 7 questions pending. We've got about 25 minutes left.
Okay, we'll talk about next caller.
Yeah, here comes our next question.
Dean, this is Roger Pilon at the Cato Institute. I'd like to raise an issue that Ilya and I have talked about, but hasn't come up yet. And it goes to the point that Professor Bradley made about the inherent legal instability that would result from the courts splitting the difference, so to speak. And I wonder if you would comment, Professor Bradley, on this. Take marriage at bottom to be a contract. And then draw the distinction between performing marriages by officers of the state and therefore presumably giving the state's imprimatur to a same-sex marriage, which the populations of many states do not want their state to do, and simply recognizing marriages as the need comes up. And I wonder if that distinction would enable to get away from the instability that you've pointed to, at least at a fundamental level. There will be some other issues that come up, of course, like degrees of consanguinity that may differ from state to state, but I assume that that can be addressed by other means. But the fundamental distinction between recognizing and actually performing by state officials of marriages within the state.
Well, I think I get the question, Roger. And I think my answer would be that even on the assumption or accepting the invitation that you offer to treat marriage as a contract, which of course it has elements of contract, it's established by consent, but I think it's more than any contract. But I don't think the difference between licensing and recognizing would really amount to enough to make it an attractive way to look at things or to do things, if that's what you're asking. Because I think either way, what would be required, whether some out-of-state marriages are recognized, and even if none are licensed within, let's say, Tennessee, it would mean, nonetheless, that I think day in, day out, for all practical purposes, and involving how public officials, store owners, non-public but large institutions, perhaps like Notre Dame, would have to treat a couple as married, which, by your hypothesis, is a way of recognizing or treating or identifying a couple as married, which it is the people object to. So I don't know if that's clear. Let me put it even clearer. I think the source of resistance, if you want to call it resistance, to same-sex marriage is the belief that they're not marriages. And I, morally speaking, one usually doesn't want to be required to treat as married a couple which isn't. and whether that couple is licensed locally or just recognized locally, I don't think makes much, and maybe doesn't make any difference to the position and the felt injury or felt imposition of someone whose position is basically members of the same sex aren't able to marry each other. And I'm not sure how responsive that is, but
that goes to the discrimination issue, and I'm
right.
fully with you on that. If you distinguish private and public, I mean, it's my judgment that private people should be able to discriminate, like Notre Dame, for example. But the public is a different entity, and it can discriminate only on grounds, and this is now back to the equal protection issue, that are narrowly tailored. And here, that's the issue that is centrally before the court. But if it ducks it, I was thinking that at least the citizens of the state would not be required to have their officials put the state's imprimatur by actually performing the marriage through judges and so forth. If the marriage were performed by clergy, either in the state or out of the state, that would be one thing. But essentially, the state would be getting out of the business of marriage.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's worth pursuing, and perhaps we can do it offline. But I'd say one more thing, which I think leaves me with doubts about the attractiveness of what you're describing. I mean, it seems to me, even though we call it a marriage license, and no matter what people casually think it's doing, I do think that in our legal tradition, for that matter, in our religious traditions, in our moral traditions, I think that even the state's license doesn't constitute or establish a marriage. I think that the state's minister or justice of the peace or whoever it is really an official or authoritative witness to the marriage which the couples enter into or the couple enters into. I think people, you know, enter into marriage by the exchange of vows, and their marriage license in the presence of a state official doesn't constitute or establish anything. It's rather, although we call it a license, that's the state's authoritative witness to the marriage that the couple has entered into. So again, I'm not inclined to think in terms of a sharp or even any real distinction between license and recognize. I think even licensing is an awkward way of saying the state has recognized and registered and will now treat as married the couple which has just married each other.
Well, gentlemen, we seem to be raising as many questions as we're answering here. So we're still facing 8 questions, but let's go to our next caller now.
This is Matthew Kazmarek with the Liberty Institute in Dallas, Texas. And given that various state legislatures are going to be looking at this issue in April and then, of course, June when the opinion issues, of all the various religious liberty statutes that are in the mix, whether it's MARPA, Child Welfare Provider Inclusion Acts, and given everything the Department of Justice has done with its Spirit of Windsor memos and the EEOC has done with Title VII memos, which of the various legislative enactments would serve as the best defense of religious liberties, either federal or state? I know there are many options out there, but given that adoption agencies are going to be in the crosshairs, foster care facilities, religious schools, we've now seen the repeal of the Armstrong Amendment there by the D.C. City Council. Of everything that you see in the field, what should we prioritize first? I'm inclined to think something like MARFA at a federal level and then, state by state. But I would like to hear your thoughts.
I just have a quick thought. This is Ilya Shapiro. I'm not familiar with much of the legislation other than the federal RFRA and the state mini RFRAs, which should be all you really need. Although in the case of the New Mexico wedding photographer, that wasn't enough. Even though New Mexico has a state RFRA, that state Supreme Court said that nevertheless, the fine against the wedding photographer for not wanting to work the same-sex ceremony was valid. So it's, I mean, at the end of the day, you can write in a very good legislation, but if the state Supreme Court or the state judiciary ultimately doesn't follow it, I think you're at a loss. And I think that will be the next battleground, and that's why it's just as important, if not more so, how the majority opinion is written, assuming that the state marriage laws are struck down, as that they are, because this will certainly, just like the Windsor precedent, both the majority and Scalia's dissent have been used a lot in all of these challenges to state laws. How the court decides Obergefell will mean a lot, I think, just as much going forward as what legislation states pass.
Let's move on to our next question.
Yes, this is David Arthur in the Dallas area, and I had a question just about the language, just the term same-sex marriage and gay marriage in and of themselves, and maybe I'm, maybe that ship has sailed and we're 10 years behind, and maybe it matters more for public relations purposes than for Supreme Court arguments, but it seems to me that the phrases in themselves are oxymorons, a contradiction in terms. And as lawyers who know that oftentimes he who frames the issue wins the argument, it seems that many have given in too easily to the labels of same-sex marriage and gay marriage as opposed to describing them as, say, you know, gay relationships or homosexual relationships, and asking the question whether or not those are entitled to the same acknowledgement or rights or benefits as men and women who are in marriage relationships. Do you see any opportunity for that line of thinking to make a comeback, or do you feel that ship has sailed?
This is Jerry Bradley. I think the ship has sailed. I think it's better, given the available ways of speaking, to say same-sex marriage, because strictly speaking, a same-sex marriage doesn't have to be between two gay people. It usually is, I'm sure, but it doesn't have to be. So I think same-sex marriage is a better term, and I think to take on board, recognizing what you're pointing us to, namely the position of many people in this debate, including myself, which is that same-sex marriages really aren't possible, that marriage is the kind of thing that's intrinsically suited and available to opposite-sex couples. For what it's worth, when I write about this issue, I tend to say, or write, same-sex marriage, although with the word marriage in scare quotes. Beyond that, I don't think, in conscience, one with, let's say, my conservative views about marriage is required to go. And that you're not giving away something that shouldn't be given away by saying same-sex marriage, perhaps with scare quotes.
Well, I like the scare quotes, or referring to it as so-called same-sex marriage, but it just seems to be giving up the debate way too easily.
Ilya Shapiro, do you have anything on this point?
No, I mean it's just. The nature of language. It's a lot easier to say same-sex marriage or gay marriage than to say, relationships that presume to the title of marriage or some other circumlocution. It's just too much of a mouthful, and so I don't even think that framing was any sort of concerted effort to lawyer the term at the outset of the debate. I think it's just much easier to talk about even same-sex marriage rather than marriage between two people of the same sex. So
let's take another question at this point.
Hi, this is Mark Oveson. I'm in Denver. I have a question that maybe goes a little beyond the bounds of today's discussion, but I'm curious to see where you think this may go. It would seem that the more progressive types have hit on a real winning strategy here, which is to say you modify the society by modifying the definitions of the society. And in this case, the definition of marriage, which everybody, 30 years ago sort of took for granted, is now on the verge of a complete redefinition, not only in the cultural sense, but or in the sense of common everyday usage, but now I believe will be redefined by the Supreme Court. It seems to me that the next frontier of this strategy would be the redefinition of the terms man and woman. And you're already starting to see that take place in the schools, where you're starting to see, even in athletics, someone who says, I know I look like a boy and I have boy parts, but I'm a girl. And it seems to me that it's not going to be very long before we start hearing about 14th Amendment rights to, call yourself what you will and participate as you will in, sports and other endeavors that traditionally have been separated between boys, girls, men, and women. What do you think? Is this distinguishable, or do you think that's you're going to see that coming at some point?
I'll just say, this is Ilya Shapiro. I'll just say real quickly that marriage is a legal concept as well as a moral one, a philosophical, all these things, whereas man, woman are biology, are biological ones. So I think it's kind of a lot easier, even as those who engage in semantic games might do something else. And but I do think the state is not involved in licensing someone as a particular gender, and until it gives you that license or that official title, you're neither gender or something like that. And so it's just a further step. There's a difference between science and law.
Okay, well, that seems like a pretty neat answer. However, if you look at Minnesota right now, you've got Minnesota school districts that are being required to allow boys to play girls' sports with girls and vice versa, because any boy who says, I feel like a girl, is not allowed to be discriminated against.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is Jerry Bradley. I think gender identity and sexual orientation, which is what we're talking about in this question, are different things. The latter, gender identity, is fundamentally, I think, a matter of one's own sort of understanding, acceptance or rejection or attitude towards one's body, which is not the same thing as sexual orientation. I think that nonetheless, there are some common roots to, let's call it, the same-sex marriage movement and the more extravagant manifestations of a gender identity movement that I think you're referring to in Minnesota. There are some common roots. I'll just mention one. In some fashion, at the root of each is a kind of deep subjectivity, even a solipsism when it comes to sex and sexual identity, and that this deep subjectivity, which is itself a cluster of notions about what counts as real and authentic and good for that person, what is a matter of enjoyment and what is thought to constitute flourishing. But I'm saying that this cluster has to do with sort of definitions that are deeply subjective and notions of well-being that are deeply subjective, where the corollary social responsibility is to affirm, endorse, ratify, recognize each one and each one's subjectivity. Now, if one does that, I think then that's the common root, and then it's simply different channels coming out of the common root or different stalks growing up out of the common root. One of them would be same-sex marriage and the another would be gender identity.
And so I guess...
Hello. Can you hear me? Hello.
Hello?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. We can hear you. Go right ahead.
Okay, yes, thank you. It seems to me this debate has morphed in such a way that we seem to understand that gays are now the new blacks, and the 14th Amendment, which came out of the Civil War, seemed to imply that the Civil War was somehow fought to, in some way, redefine marriage. It's been morphed in this way, and I don't, quite kind of disturbing. Would it be helpful for the advocate on behalf of federalism before the court to just take a deep breath and say, how did we get here? So, for example, the definition of marriage was understood for centuries between one man and one woman, or at least between men and women, and no one thought anything of it up until a few years ago. And no one thought at the time the architects of marriage were doing anything that had anything to do with homosexuals, trying to exclude them or disparage them in any way. I think also the DOMA, when that was passed, I think it wasn't, didn't just happen out of thin air. It was a reaction to those who were trying to redefine a centuries-old institution. So it was just trying to say, let's not, you know, upset the apple cart. Let's keep things consistent. But you know, the terms like banning gay marriage sound more like banning interracial marriage. I mean, even the term marriage equality rhymes with racial equality. So again, this 14th Amendment thing keeps, you know, popping up. So I do think that the same-sex marriage issue is kind of like cousin marriage. So the question is, would a state be able to decide, well, yes, half the states have cousin marriage in some form or another, but could they say, well, we don't want to recognize it here through federalism? And if that's the case, I think you have the same argument with same-sex marriage. So I'd like to hear your response to that.
This is Ilya Shapiro. I'll go first. Of course, the Civil War was not fought over gay rights. What it was fought over was, can states violate individual rights? And the 14th Amendment, most obviously was slavery, which is why we have the 13th Amendment. And then the 14th Amendment went further and said, you can now appeal to federal courts if states are violating individual rights. You couldn't do that anymore. The post-Civil War amendments fundamentally transformed, some people say perfected, our constitutional order, and that your individuals were no longer just protected against federal oppression, but against state as well. So the issue here isn't whether someone had in mind gay marriage when they were ratifying the 14th Amendment, although they did have in mind marriage in a certain context. One of the particular ways in which slaves were oppressed by the states was denied, they were denied a marriage right. But does the state have sufficient justification for treating different people differently on these grounds? In other words, to kind of lower the temperature from a comparison to the civil rights era and whether gays are the new blacks, is to say, is this more like a state law that denies a driving license, a driver's license to a blind person, or is it more like a law that denies a business license to a blind person? What ultimately is the state's justification? And that's something that overwhelmingly, at least in the last few years, although not exclusively, the states or those who are defending the traditional conception of marriage have been unable to establish to court satisfaction.
The issue of individual rights, I agree. Everyone for centuries has had the individual right to marry, including homosexuals. But the marriage definition is always between women and men. So, I mean, it may be inconvenient for homosexuals that that's the definition, but I see in no way that the 14th Amendment would compel a state to recognize the same-sex union, because again, the individual right has not been breached anyway. It's just a matter of taste. They say, well, we want to be in the same-sex relationship, fine, but let's not change the definition of marriage. At least not let the 14th Amendment do it. That's really the thing that's really truly insulting to me. It's utterly ridiculous to imply that the Equal Protection Clause had anything to do with, you know, recognizing same-sex marriages.
Professor Bradley, do you have a comment here?
No, a brief one. I confidently agree that the Civil War was not fought for same-sex marriage, and I do think, nonetheless, that the comparison to racial equality, and especially to the Loving case of 1966, the Supreme Court's decision against state laws banning interracial marriage, I think that's been exploited falsely, but shamelessly, and to some positive effect by those urging same-sex marriage on courts. All too many courts have fallen for the false analogy to Loving. What I would say, on the other hand, is that the Equal Protection Clause, the Due Process Clause for that matter, really, I think, are rightly read to prohibit states from making arbitrary distinctions among citizens, and that those clauses ban pointless discrimination, and much more so, you might say, bigoted or prejudiced discrimination, which is to say not anything in favor of recognizing same-sex marriage, but at least to say that there does need to be a reasonable, rational basis for traditional marriage and for states to recognize only marriages between men and women and not marriages between two men or two women. Now, I think that that basis exists and has been expressed well over the years. Unfortunately, it has not persuaded as many courts and others that it should. But I do think it's fair to judge or to observe that the Constitution requires that there be a non-arbitrary basis for limiting legal recognition of marriage to opposite-sex couples. And in that perhaps modest but not inconsequential way, I think there's a legitimate 14th Amendment question in these cases.
We're technically out of our budgeted time here. We've got two questions pending. Let's take I'm going to check in with both callers and see if they'll frame their questions and then go to both of our experts and get their responses. It looks like we lost our questions. Go right ahead, caller. This will be the last question, sounds like.
Okay, thanks very much. Steve McCloskey, Winston-Salem, North Carolina. One question for Ilya, one for Jerry. Ilya, I assume this is going to be decided on a rational basis review. Other than Judeo-Christian values, could you elucidate some other rational bases by which the states could justify their prohibition against gay marriage? And for Jerry, is there any significance to the fact that cert was granted to the Sixth Circuit cases which prohibited gay marriage versus the Fourth and Ninth cases which upheld a right to gay marriage? Thanks very much.
Sure. This is Ilya Shapiro. Marriage is a kind of a universal context, not state marriage, which, you know, the idea of a couple holding themselves out to the community as a union, et cetera, is predates, you know, state marriage licensing laws, and it's not just in Judeo-Christian societies or nations. I guess the strongest justification for traditional marriage is provided by the excellent book by Robbie George and Ryan Anderson and Sharice Girgis, What is Marriage? If you want to read, you know, much better than any legal brief that's been filed or what have you, this is kind of in a nutshell. It's a very readable book about what the other side believes, that other side to me, that the traditional marriage proponents believe and why, and it's not religious justifications. Ultimately, I think the issue is precisely that here, the way that the litigation is developed, the way that our understanding of the relationship between the individual and the state and the federal government or the Constitution is that this is about state marriage licenses and what is the state's justification for not extending them to same-sex couples. And the arguments that have the non-religious arguments that have been presented to them, whether it's in the context of the benefit of the children, or whatever the case might be, the idea that if we allow same-sex marriage licensing, then that will diminish marriages between opposite-sex couples, or whatever is provided to maintain the safety, the reproductive interests of the human race, all of these sorts of things. I don't want to put words in the mouths of the other side, but these have, in where they have failed, have been for the reason that courts have found those not to be sufficient. And I kind of disagree that this will ultimately come down to a rational basis style review, which doesn't mean to say that I think they'll invoke heightened scrutiny or strict scrutiny. I kind of think, especially, which after all are artificial levels of of jurisprudence concocted by the court when they bifurcated our rights during the New Deal. Ultimately, especially if Kennedy is the one writing this opinion, you won't see a label of, well, I'm deciding this under rational basis, or I'm deciding this under strict scrutiny, or what have you. I think it'll ultimately just say the state has not borne its burden of justification for why it is conducting its marriage licensing law in this manner.
Professor Bradley, sounds like you get the final word here.
Well, my final word is that I, at some risk of seeming to reach up and pick the low-hanging fruit, the only reason I can think of for the court to grant review in the Sixth Circuit case is that it's the one circuit that ruled against same-sex marriage. I wouldn't myself say prohibit it, but states are refusing to recognize it. But be that as it may, until that point, there wasn't a circuit split. I was as surprised as most people were, and I think most of us were very surprised when the court declined to review or announced it would not grant cert in a bunch of marriage cases in early October. I thought myself, as many others did, that the court's sense of responsibility for unleashing that mini wave of judicial invalidation of traditional marriage laws would really call for the court to settle what it meant in Windsor and whether lower courts, including two or three circuits, were reading Windsor correctly in reading Windsor to invalidate state laws not recognizing same-sex marriage. But the court surprised many of us and didn't take those cases. But I think once the circuit split was created, I think the court most likely felt that its responsibility or the time to pay the piper had come due. And I can't think of any more than that at work. There's nothing especially remarkable about the district court opinions in these cases, nor the issues presented to Ohio, Tennessee at all. So I just think it happens to be the circuit split came around and it was time to settle the matter at the highest level.
Well, gentlemen, thank you for a fascinating discussion. There will be more to be said. Maybe we'll have another preview as the amicus briefs come in and maybe the arguments are sharp and more information is available. We'll certainly check back in after argument and then after decisions in this case. My thanks to both Professor Jerry Bradley and Ilya Shapiro. We certainly appreciate your time, especially going over here, going beyond the hour commitment. And my thanks to the audience as well for your engagement and your questions. A reminder to the audience about our next scheduled Teleforum conference call tomorrow at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, when we'll be looking at the Crime Victims Restitution Act and whether it's being followed in the Eastern District of New York. It's tomorrow at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.